Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome, everyone, to this Peak Prosperity podcast. It is February 13th, 2017, and I'm Chris Martinson, of course. For the past week, the Oroville Dam in Oroville, California, has been rapidly filling up and then finally topping over the emergency spillway. All week as well, the authorities and media have been saying everything's fine, no worries, all is under control. And then suddenly, last night, that's Sunday night, that would be the 12th of February, the emergency notice went out for 10,000 people to evacuate just the low-lying areas downstream from Oroville itself to Gridley, California. Within hours, that had been expanded to nearly 190,000 people. Cars were packed with people who left with literally the shirts on their backs, not having had any sufficient warning to do anything more than that. And we know this because they were so hopelessly stuck in stopped traffic that reporters were able to walk up, knock on windows, and conduct full interviews. Now, as soon as I became aware of the situation, I began to scour the net for useful, high-quality information. As you know, in the early times, it's sometimes very difficult to find out what's going on. Now, one piece I came across was written by Scott Cahill, a dam contractor with tons of experience in the sorts of dams that we see at Oroville. It caught me right away, his piece of writing, as being full of actual terms and experience and knowledge, so I wanted to bring him on to discuss both this dam and the situation in Oroville and the general state of dams in the United States more broadly. Now, as you know, we discuss infrastructure here and the sorry state of it from time to time, and now we have a perfect reason to re-engage in that conversation. Scott Cahill, he's a construction expert, a writer, a speechwriter, public speaker, expert witness, sailor. Hey, he's a pilot too. He has 40 years of large construction and development experience with over a half a billion in completed projects, including very high security installations and very high level finish work, including stuff for the FBI, the CIA, armed forces, military installations. He's done work on hospitals, water and wastewater, bridges, airports, industrial, commercial, institutional buildings, and of course, dams. He's been a professional witness for construction issues and for dam issues, and is a FEMA trainer for dam safety, has dozens of papers and presentations on dam safety to his name. He is currently the owner of Watershed Services of Ohio, which completes work on dams in the eastern U.S., including specialty underwater and diving work. So, with all of that said, welcome, Scott. Hey, thank you so much for joining us on such short notice.
It's great to be here, and thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, now first, Scott, did I leave anything out that people might need to know or want to know about you to assess your qualifications or experience here?
No, I think you got it. For the last 20 years or so, I've done dams almost exclusively. So I've had the opportunity to work on literally hundreds of dams, many, many of them earthen embankment dams of the sort that we're talking about here with Lake Oroville.
All right, and so let's talk about that for a second. Earthen embankment dams, what is it that you've experienced with them, and what do we need to know about them?
Well, an earthen embankment dam, like the one that we're talking about here, is generally an earthen fill that takes place between two abutting surfaces. In this case, it's fairly high recovery rock on either side, which form the abutments. And then the central dam itself is placed out of soils, which are compacted in place. The Oroville Dam has a semi-permeous centroid, which is made up of graded clays, and it has the mass of the dam, which creates the sloped surfaces, the faces of the dam, if you will, is composed of a stony soil, which was mined close by and brought to the site by train. It has a chimney drain in it to vent phreatic water, which is the groundwater that migrates laterally through a dam, so that it doesn't manifest on the downstream face and cause it to be wet and to slough. The mass of the dam itself, actually the weight of the soils, are what resist the forces, the lateral forces of the water that are induced on it. So It's a magnificently large dam, 770 feet tall, 6,920 feet long, a massive, massive, massive dam built in 1968.
Now, Scott, I've built dams like this at the beach before when you have water coming back down. Again, you have the two faces and you slope them all up. And my experience with those at the beach is that everything's cool until it's not. The worry being that once water begins to penetrate anywhere along there, it's over pretty quick. Is that the general nature of earthen dams? Is that a feature that would be applicable here at Oroville, or is that just something that you find in sand at the beach?
No, it is so close that it's frightening, Chris. That's exactly what we're talking about here. We have the dam itself, which is made up of erodible soils. Adjacent to the dam in what's called the groin, where the dam abuts the abutting soils, we have the principal spillway, and then farther laterally from the dam itself, we have the emergency spillway. And they are, as much as is possible, are in a surface that's rock, and that is the situation with Oroville.
All right, so just to be clear, there's only a few ways for water to on an approved basis leave the Lake Oroville, and one is through the electrical generating facilities that are at the base of the dam. The second would be down what we're calling the spillway, and then, as you mentioned, a little further along. So if we're facing the dam, towards the lake, further along to the left is the emergency spillway, which, by the way, got renamed the auxiliary spillway at some point during the week, I guess, to take the word emergency out of the title. But those are the three places, and I heard they shut down the power generating station for some reason. All this water's going down the spillway, which is where some trouble emerged, and then also water was topping and going over the emergency spillway, if we can just use that word. It's easier for me to pronounce than auxiliary. Yeah. So tell us what happened. What how did this develop, and what occurred here?
Well, the principal spillway, the normal way that we move water from the basin, from the pool out to discharge it, is along the principal spillway. It's lined with concrete, what we call plate slabs, concrete slabs which are reinforced on the base, and then training walls on either side. The water travels down, going through the gates at the crest of the dam, traveling down the spillway at a magnificently high velocity. And in fact, in this particular dam, it's falling so far, so fast, that they put some blocks at the bottom to break up that velocity so that it didn't scour downstream. So this is a nice, clean, concrete channel that exists down and spilling into the Feather River below. The emergency spillway in this particular dam is what we call an OG weir. It's a concrete structure with a level top that's set at an elevation below the crest of the earth of the dam itself, so that in the event that water gets up to that elevation, it will begin to spill over that weir and down the side of the abutting soils and into the river below.
All right, so I read an article this morning. It was from writing about 12 years ago. 12 years ago, groups such as the Friends of the Earth, the Sierra Club, the South Yuba Citizens League, they filed a motion with the federal government. It was on October 17, 2005, and I'm reading here now from a Mercury News article, which I will now quote. As part of Oroville Dam's relicensing process, urging federal officials to require that the dam's emergency spillway be armored with concrete rather than remain as an earthen hillside, the groups filed the motion with FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. They said that the dam built and owned by the state of California, finished in 1968, did not meet modern safety standards because in the event of extreme rain and flooding, fast rising water would overwhelm the main concrete spillway and then flow down the emergency spillway, and that could cause heavy erosion that would create flooding for communities downstream, but could also cause a failure known as loss of crest control, end quote, Scott, isn't that exactly what happened here?
That is precisely what happened here. I also am aware of that action, a motion filed with FERC. They really understood what the eventuality of the actuation of that emergency spillway may be. And in fact, something that one looks for in doing an inspection of a dam, particularly a FERC-regulated dam, is that an emergency spillway produces a flat, canted plain that's unencumbered by any woody vegetation or brush or anything like that. I don't know if you saw, Chris, the pictures of this thing, but this is near forested in this area, covered with trees. In fact, literally a day or two before the spillway crested, they had employees out pouring concrete in the corner where the OG Weir meets the structure of the gate structure, and also removing the trees and vegetation from the emergency spillway. So that's indicative of improper maintenance of that spillway by, I think, anyone's feelings. It's highly unusual to see a high hazard dam, particularly a FERC-regulated high hazard dam. FERC does a great job with their dams generally, that has vegetation on an emergency spillway. Very much a no-no.
And what happened? Why is that a no-no?
The reason for it is that you want as much as possible to have a sheeted flow down that emergency spillway. When such a flow meets a tree, the tree, of course, will eventually fail. It doesn't take long, as you can see from the velocities that we're witnessing in this dam. And then the root ball proceeds down. When the root ball falls out of the embankment, it produces a hole, and that hole produces what we call a hydraulic jump. You can imagine like a tiny waterfall and circulatory water there. And it begins what's called cutback. It's an erosion that migrates from the imperfection back toward the basin, toward the pool of the dam, exactly as has happened in the weathered rock within the emergency spillway.
All right. So as I understand it right now, the emergency spillway was a problem. You're right. There were pictures of them. Looked like tiny ants. It looked so insignificant. Quick shoving some boulders and concrete into some corners of that whole emergency spillway. But the spillway itself, now that we've been at this for 24 hours, we've noticed that, yes, there was damage to that spillway that it had been noted a long time ago. They'd done some sort of a patch. It failed. A huge hole opened up in the main spillway itself. And then that was also back eroding, presumably from the same hydraulic hole sort of a process you just described with the root ball, only much larger. Let's talk about the spillway for a moment, because that's what people were worried might fail. What does that even mean if a spillway fails?
The primary spillway, this is the concrete structure that we discussed earlier, yep, was last inspected in 2015. During that inspection, they did not actually go down into the spillway and shove cameras in holes and look at the soils beneath. From what I understand, they did a visual inspection of it from a distance, believe it or not. In 2013, some work took place on the spillway to repair a scour and a failure of the plate slabs. And in fact, the failure that's manifested itself on the spillway today, which is a huge erosion, both the plate slab's complete failure and failure adjacent to the side under the training wall and out, and basically the bottom third or half of the spillway is now gone. That happened in exactly the same place, or it started in the same place that work was completed. The other item, Chris, that really promoted me to write my writing on this was I noticed some photographs of this spillway when it was actuated. There are drains all along the training walls, the two walls on the side of the spillway that form the sluiceway of the spillway. Those drains should be dripping some water, some groundwater that may collect behind those walls. These were not. There was actually, and you can, if you look this up online, you can see photographs of this, where those drains are actually firing water out across the spillway, shooting it out under pressure.
Oh.
That's indicative of a charged situation where water's getting underneath the spillway, and the eventuality of that is a lifting of the slabs and exactly what we saw. When I saw the charged system, I came to realize that the principal spillway was in a failure mode, and that's what caused me to write the things that I wrote, that I felt that it was imminent that the principal spillway fail. Now, we're kind of in a worst case scenario, if you will, and I don't want to be an alarmist, but there are two ways to remove significant amounts of water from that dam. The power plant penstocks will only move a small amount of water compared to either of the spillways. The principal spillway, which should be the only spillway used, is now severely damaged. They have allowed the emergency spillway to actuate, but on actuating the emergency spillway, they find that it's significantly damaged and has serious cutback that's going to compromise the dam. So, rain's coming, basin's full, both spillways are damaged. We're in a very, very serious predicament here with that dam. This is not a good situation to be in. We get to choose which spillway we pour water down, and we will probably choose the spillway that is cutting back the slowest toward the eventuality of a release of pull.
Well, now, wait, let me make sure that's important what you're saying here, Scott, so let me make sure I have this. So the choices now include they're dumping 100,000 cubic feet per second, I believe, or is that per minute? What's the measure here?
Second.
That's per second. Just massive quantities of water. So they're still dumping that. That's coming down the damaged spillway. And they're doing that because they say, well, we've got more rain coming. We absolutely don't want to be topping any more over the emergency spillway. So it sounds like they've made the decision, based on what you just told me, that risking more damage down the main spillway is preferable to any more topping coming over the emergency spillway. They're kind of, the devil is in the, you know, if you damned if you do, damned if you don't. But the emergency spillway seems to scare them more than the primary spillway at this point. Is that correct?
Exactly. What they had said only, you know, probably a day ago was that this wasn't a significant problem, because if we simply close the gates, the valves on the top end of the principal spillway, then the water will rise and will spill over the emergency spillway, and the emergency spillway has a magnificent capacity to move water. Well, when they allowed just a bit of water to run over the emergency spillway, they soon found, with the velocities of only a portion of the water that could be moving over that emergency spillway, they had such severe scour that they anticipated a failure of the structural elements within 45 minutes. That initiated them moving people out of the inundation zone beneath the dam. And now I believe the thought is that the cutback on the principal spillway is slower than the failure mode on the emergency spillway. So they're going to vent water down that principal spillway as much as they can without failing that element.
Now, Scott, how would they be tracking the cutback on the spillway at this point in time? How would they really know what's happening down there?
Well, I don't know why this is, Chris, and this sounds silly, but these things always seem to happen at night. nothing happens when you can look at it. And always, it's almost a joke in the dam safety community that when something bad starts to happen, you send a lot of engineers out to look at it. You know, that's the response. And maybe it works, because at nights, when these things always seem to happen, they're visually watching the cutback proceed up the spillway, taking plate by plate and section by section of the training walls, stepping back toward the dam. At the top of the dam there, of course, it breaks over at the crest and falls down the sluiceway of the spillway. At the top, there is a large concrete structure, the right-hand side of that structure. And when in dams, we always talk about looking from the reservoir downstream. So the right-hand structure, right-hand part of that structure is anchored into bedrock, and the left-hand side of that structure comes awfully close to meeting the embankment soils of the dam itself. Of course, if water moves across the embankment soils of the dam, then there will be severe erosion of the dam, and the eventuality of that would be a breach. So we certainly don't ever want that to happen. And before that would happen, the emergency spillway would run full bore, whether they wanted it to or not. There's no way to control that. And as it did, then it would start to take out components, for instance, that OG weir that we talked about, which is the controlling structure. When it did that, it would allow too much water, another 10 or 20 feet out of the lake very, very quickly. And the result of that failure of the elements of the emergency spillway will be significant flooding downstream.
Significant, like we're losing, what, 20 feet of the lake surface all at once? Well, not all at once, but I mean, that's going to drain as fast as it knows how through whatever gap is created, right?
Exactly, Chris. And unfortunately, in that eventuality, because it would be allowing so much water to move so rapidly down that rock, especially since we now see that the rock is not high recovery, which is very solid rock, but is weathered rock. And we see that it's actually cutting back under some really slight flows here. That emergency spillway has never been actuated in the history of this dam since it was constructed in 1968. And we find that after an hour or two, we have significant failure of the soils in the abutments, and in fact, a scour that's headed the whole way back and threatens the OG weir, the only controlling structure there. So if the lake was to release, the question then is how much of those abutting soils with an extra 10 or 20 feet of water rolling down there, extremely violent kind of a hydraulic event, would be eroded away, allowing even more of the lake to discharge.
Now, I haven't seen any of the actual engineering drawings on this. Do we know where bedrock is under all of this?
I do not have the geological studies on the thing. You can see bedrock in photographs. So it is obvious that there is bedrock in both of the abutting sections here. You know, there are different grades of bedrock, and they call rock which has been exposed to the surface, as this has, weathered rock, or sometimes rotten rock. That is rock which has fissures and breaks in it, which is erodible under very high velocity. And that is what we're seeing in this emergency spillway. We're seeing the rock actually get washed away and leave this void, which is that cutback failure mode. And that void continues to migrate back, threatening the pool itself.
All right. So, Scott, take us to the moment. I'm sure this was very difficult for all the people involved who had to make the call. But this went from basically, hey, we're a little concerned, and maybe 10,000 you need to go, to 188,000. That was a very quick sort of a progression there. Certainly, they must have been very worried by what they were seeing at that point in time. How do they make a call like that? And what do you think they were seeing that made them so concerned?
What they saw, of course, was this cutback migrating back toward the OG weir, and they recognized the seriousness of that. I think you stepped into an area there, Chris, where I think we have a real failure as a society. And that is that we want to placate people. We want not to upset people. We become so careful that we actually... you know, the way that the conversation went was, there's no problem, there's no problem, there's no problem, evacuate.
Right.
That never should go that way. I find that a real fault. And I think that at the point when an emergency spillway was actuated, that had never before been actuated. That means that the water level within Lake Oroville was higher than it had ever been in the history of that dam. Certainly, you're inducing loads on the dam itself that it's never seen before. The people downstream have a right to understand that, emphatically. They have a right to be told the truth. And I don't think that anyone's doing anything with malice here. I think that they're trying to do their job, trying to serve the people they work for, the owners of the dam, the state. I think they're trying to do what they believe to be right. But I believe that it results in an unfair situation to the people living below this dam. The way that the communication took place, I have personally have a problem with it. I think that we should have been much more straightforward with people, and we should have said to them, we're going to let this actuate, and it's going to be quite an event, and we're going to watch it, and we don't know what's going to happen. Hopefully it'll be all right, but maybe it won't be. And to begin to allow people to start the process of planning, if indeed it became necessary, worst case scenario, that they leave the area, as indeed has played out here.
All right. Well, indeed, I agree with you completely around that, because it's, to me, it's tragic that people left with the shirts on their back in many cases, not even having the opportunity to spend 20 minutes gathering family photos or other things like that, or whatever might be needed to spend some time away. But second of all, they were given no guidance in terms of how long they might be away. And knowing that we have another storm coming and it's going to take more engineers with more daylight and more eyeballs to sort of assess where things actually are, putting yourself in the shoes of somebody who does live in one of these downstream communities, perhaps in a low-lying area, if you lived there downstream, who would you believe at this point in time? When would you feel comfortable moving back, you personally?
I, well, that's a hard one to answer, truly, Chris. It's a shame. Understand that beneath the conversation, there's a very finite emergency action plan, which was drawn up and practiced. And in fact, if you look at the FEMA dam safety booklet, on the cover, the front cover of it, is a picture of this dam. This dam is on the front cover of the emergency action planning book published by FEMA. So, you know, the paper trail behind this is probably very, very sound. The failure, I believe, was in the methodology of conveying this information. And, you know, I don't want to be critical of people that are going through hell right now, but I wish that they had let people pack a bag and get it in their car. You know, you can always go back out and get it and say, wasn't that silly? But, you know, I wish that they'd have said to people the truth. The truth being that we just don't know. The truth being that there are some things that simply can't be calculated because there are simply too many variables.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, this is where I, just as a commentary, to say everything's fine, evacuate, that's trust damaging, I think. So for somebody like myself who's kind of safety conscious, I would want to, it would take me a little while to trust their next pronouncements, which are everything's okay. Because my instinct is that government officials seem to want to placate. We saw this play out with Fukushima big time. You know, it took them 3 years to admit that they had 3 full core meltdowns, but they knew that probably within hours. And so this is, you know, when we get into these large scale things, you know, some of the very best reporting I've seen on this, where the truth was actually being talked about in non-alarmist, but very, I think, realistic tones, were by citizens, not government officials, who were tracking this whole thing from beginning to end. So what I'm trying to do, though, is I do have people from the area who listen to me, and I'm trying to answer the question for them, which is, who should they listen to now? What information would you trust?
It's a difficult situation. It's a situation that I've dealt with in the arena of dam safety for a very long time. If you remember back a ways to Katrina, stay where you are, help is on the way.
Mm-hmm.
The question being, can we trust our government to disseminate information to us in our best interest? And I'm afraid, Chris, that the answer is we cannot.
Mm.
The ultimate responsibility is on each individual.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you get that information that can allow you to make a determination that is valid for yourself? I mean, there are people in their 80s who don't move quickly. There mm-hmm. are people who it's a big deal to go out and get in the car and move. There are people with disabilities. There are people with special needs. I don't know. It's a failure, Chris, and we got to do better. We've got to do better. I think that I see these things where we have people who are trained in this and they communicate, and I see failure after failure after failure. And to just candidly and honestly answer your question, no, I don't trust what they're saying myself. I had, when I wrote my piece, I had people come on who were engineers and lambast me and say, you know, you don't know what you're talking about and how could you say these things? And it's completely safe and the emergency spillway is huge and on and on and on. And, you know, I want to believe that everything's going to be okay. And I don't want to be an alarmist, but there is an issue of responsibility there. We have to be telling people what is actually going on. And time again, we have failed to do that honorably and properly. And maybe it's because we just wish for things to be better. It's very frightening to be the engineer or the person running a dam that has a serious issue. You know, I imagine these guys are not sleeping at night or petrified or are worried sick. If they're not, they should get another job. They should be. But we have to find a better way to communicate. And who can you trust? Chris Martinson and maybe Scott Cahill.
Right.
You know, for now, I hope that that's improved though, Chris.
Oh, me too. I agree completely with what you've said. And of course, I don't disagree that people taking more personal responsibility, I don't disagree with that being a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. And that's a more engaged citizenry is a wonderful thing in most cases. So in this case, though, you know, the Oroville Dam, I don't think was really, Scott, I don't think it was on a lot of people's radar screen. But as you say, this is not just a dam. It's one of the 20 largest dams in the world. It's on the cover of the FEMA emergency, you know, manual you talked about for dam safety, I believe. And so this is actually a pretty big reservoir for California. What do you think is in the future for the Oroville Dam? Is it just compromised and has to operate at a lower capacity, or can it, in your experience, can they rehabilitate it to full duty, or what happens now, do you think?
Well, what's going to happen now, Chris, is that we're going to spend a magnificent amount of money on a simple problem that could have been satisfied with a very small expenditure. The balance between maintenance and capital projects is ridiculously one-sided.
Hmm.
And having allowed this to occur, there's now, when I first wrote my article, I said, you know, you're talking about a $200,000, $300,000 job to grout under that spillway, and you're going to be talking about $5 million to repair the hole. Well, now, in a matter of hours, it's become a $200 million problem. It's going to be a magnificent amount of money. The state of California cannot afford not to have the water that is held in Lake Oroville.
Mm.
So we must repair the dam. And on a broader sense, we must repair many, many dams. But this particular dam, I feel, and of course, we don't know how far this goes. Let us hope that we're simply repairing some pretty severe erosion and some serious damage to two spillways. That would be as good as it will get at this point. As bad as it will get at this point would be a V-notch breach, which is incorporation of the failure into the dam itself. And that would be very, very difficult indeed, both from a permitting standpoint and ecological standpoint, and for so many reasons. That would be a very difficult thing, and it would be a very difficult thing for the people of California who so desperately need the water. It would take a very long time to get that pool reestablished.
Right. Well, especially after they've just come out of a pretty punishing drought. Obviously, a lot of water sensitivity around these issues now. So this is it's really symbolic on a lot of levels. And so you started to mention what I want to get into here for the final part of this is let's broaden this up, Scott. Let's talk about the state of dams across the U.S. in general. I'm sure it's a mixed bag. Some are probably pretty great shape and some are not. But how many would you say are on the worrisome side of the tracks, and how do we measure and talk about that? What's the language here?
It's an interesting problem. The finest dams in the United States, I believe, are the dams which are under the control of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, as is this dam. There are many dams which are in horrible, horrible shape, unbelievable shape across the United States. Many states have 4,000 dams. Many states have 2,000 and 3,000 dams. Of those dams, I would imagine that 20% are in an absolutely untenable situation. And when we look at this dam, which is a highly regulated dam, a dam more highly regulated than almost any others, they had an emergency spillway filled with trees. They had a principal spillway that was in the process of failing and had been for years. So if this can exist on one of the most highly regulated dams, then one can just interpolate and imagine what the rest of the situation is like. Dams and infrastructure in general in these United States have been ignored since they were constructed, many of them 100 years old, the mass of them more than 50 years old, and the design life when they were constructed, generally 50 years. It's hard politically to go back and spend the money proactively to develop safety because nothing has happened. And so with dam safety, time and time again, we act after the horrible event. Something really horrible happens and someone reacts to that and says, you know, I will never let this happen again. And indeed, we move forward. And then the pressure's off and it's not frightening anymore. And we go back to a level of complacency that allows us to get where we stand today. Dams are in terrible shape in the United States, as are all of our infrastructure. Bridges, 600,000 bridges, with 27% of them not meeting their minimum requirements. A number of these high hazard dams are not even close. There's a report card given out by the American Society of Civil Engineers, and many states' dam inventories are getting D's, D minuses, D pluses. It's hard to believe. Certainly someone in the 1960s would never believe that the United States would have these issues, but we've ignored them far too long, Chris.
I certainly have been reading a lot about that, and it's great to talk with somebody like yourself who's put eyes and feet on these things. But when you say maybe 20%, we're talking thousands and thousands of dams. And you mentioned as well that there's a very asymmetrical balance between maintenance costs and then the capital to fix something. While you were talking, I suddenly remembered, I haven't researched this, so pardon if I get the sort of the terms wrong or the dates wrong or whatnot, but I'm thinking of the coal fly ash impoundment that Duke Energy lost a while back, and it just spilled horribly into rivers and, you know, across the suburban area. Would those impoundments also count as dams, or is that a separate category entirely?
No, they do. They do. As do levees, as do all of these, anything that creates an embankment of a fluid, water, mud, anything that creates a significant embankment. That the definition changes a bit from state to state, but all of the levees that line, in fact, this dam downstream has a number of levees also that are at risk, obviously, with the evolution that happened. You touched on something else, Chris, that's really pertinent here. It's not just releasing a bunch of water downstream, and it's not even just the flood. But because this maintenance and this upgrade wasn't done, everybody, I think, has seen the water that is leaving, running down that embankment.
Mm-hmm.
This is water that's extremely turbid with a lot of soil suspended in it. This is going to cause a loss of oxygen. Fish are going to die. Habitat's going to be destroyed. This is an ecological disaster that's already taking place. Beside the liability, you know, honestly, I don't know if this dam's going to make it or not. That's a frightening statement to make. We've got rain coming, as you pointed out. It's a significant amount of rain. They're anticipating days upon days of rain. They can only lower the pool so fast because of the crippled spillways that they enjoy. And I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen here. If this dam would fail, it would be catastrophic. It would be catastrophic to the state of California. It would be catastrophic to the nation. This is an important dam and an important element of our infrastructure, and the loss of, if you set aside life, which is hard to do, and just look at the money already lost. When you move 100,000 people out of their homes, you know, you can spend a lot of money to keep that from happening. That is a huge, huge cost to the whole of us. And this ecological exacerbation is on top of that. So now we're going to lose fish. We're going to lose habitat. The stream's going to be choked with mud. The dam downstream's going to have to be dredged behind it. All because we didn't want to spend the money to do what we probably should have done with this emergency spillway, and to spend the money on the maintenance of the primary spillway.
And it sounded like relative chump change given what you just outlined there. So in closing, last question here, what sort of numbers are we talking about to fix just the dam portion of this story? Is this hundreds of millions in deferred maintenance? Is it billions? Is it trillion with a T on it? You know, we've seen big numbers that the Society for Civil Engineers is throwing around for totally getting our infrastructure in America back to first world standards. What's the dam portion of this bill, do you think? Where would we begin to get a sense of the range on this?
Wow. I calculated that not too far back, believe it or not. President Trump has said that he's willing to set aside $550 billion for infrastructure. That is a magnificent amount of money. If he would just call me, I would tell him that it needs to be closer to $2 trillion. I wish it were otherwise, but it's not. When you start adding up the numbers and applying percentages and applying averages for costs of maintenance to bring things up to an acceptable level, it goes quickly. Here is Oroville is the model. Here's the model. A contractor could have gone out and grouted the spillway and put new drains in. And if he did a really great job and fixed it all up as good as it could be, he would have spent perhaps $500,000, maybe a bit more. A contractor could have gone and lined the emergency spillway. He probably would have spent $5 million doing that. So for 5 million, call it 6 million. Now we're looking at $200 million. Not to mention all the other costs that we don't even calculate here. And God forbid if we're talking about the losses of a partial breach of a dam. It's just, it's so foolhardy to save that penny when all the dollars that are lost when things go badly, as things are doing to some level here. So I believe in it. I think we're talking about a $2 trillion problem. That all doesn't have to happen tomorrow, but it does have to happen. We can't let it go any longer. It's to a point now where we must address it.
I totally agree, and would be money well spent, obviously, and would get us up to acceptable standards for safety and quality as well, and also just the joy of living around beautiful, well-maintained things, which has a value all on its own. I just took a train from Hartford to Washington this morning and got to see the state of our rail system. This is Amtrak, not to beat on them, but lots of concrete out there that needs replacing as well. So it's very visible, it's very obvious, but in this case, it was highly disruptive. And if you think of 100,000 people, every $10 that they're out in this story, lost wages or whatever, is another $1 million in that story of loss. So for you know, penny wise, pound foolish, totally understand that really being writ large. I hope we learn the lessons from this. Not clear that we did post Katrina really get a lot of lessons out of this, but sometimes it takes two big life events to get us back on track. So with that, Scott, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. What an honor to talk with an expert such as yourself. And thank you for writing what you did and putting your name out there. And I didn't consider it alarmist at all, but rather just this is a possible thing we might consider as part of the landscape here. So again, thank you for that. And thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris. I enjoyed talking to you.